ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. If you walk from the High Court towards the National Library, you come across a monument that surely is one of its kind in Australia, a monument celebrating a judgment of the High Court. On it are these words: "The common law of this country would perpetuate injustice if it were to continue to persist in characterising the Indigenous inhabitants of Australian colonies as people too low in the scale of social organisation to be acknowledged as possessing rights and interests in land." The case is, of course, Mabo, and those are the words of Sir Gerard Brennan. As an old-fashioned man, he might have preferred them carved in stone rather than etched in steel, but they'll be there for God knows how long, celebrating that case, the court, and the man who wrote the judgment that transformed not just Aboriginal Australia. Sir Gerard died 3 years ago, and his son Frank Brennan, priest and lawyer, has now edited a massive two-volume collection of his father's speeches and papers. For the last couple of weeks, he's been moving from jurisdiction to jurisdiction for launch after launch by justices and chief justices. I'm not sure any book ever published in this country has ever had such a grand parade as a launch. Frank is now in Perth, from where he joins me to talk about the law, faith and his father. Frank, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. Great to be with you.
Would he be a bit embarrassed by all this hoo-ha, or would he secretly feel it was his due?
I don't think he'd feel it was his due, but I think he'd be secretly chuffed. He was a humble man, but he was also a man who took some pride in his judicial achievements. So I think he would be delighted that his successors in office have seen that he made a signal contribution to the jurisprudence of the country.
Tell us about his visit to the Garma Festival.
Oh, yes.
And what he found there.
Well, this was late in life. He'd long retired, and one of his daughters, Bernadette, who was a literary figure, she'd been to Garma several times. Well, eventually, Dad was convinced that he should make a visit to the Garma Festival. And so he was standing in a tent one day, I understand, and there was a placard which had quotes from his judgments in Mabo. And in one of those rare moments where his humility betrayed him, he looked rather smug at himself, so he described it, and he looked around and there were some young people there and he said, "You know, I wrote that." And they looked at him as if he was mad and walked away. He knew that he was simply one face in the crowd.
He was just an old white face at Garma.
An old fogey.
Yeah. They didn't believe him for an instant.
Indeed. And he was quite happy with that.
Let's start with his birth in 1928 in Rockhampton, to a Labor family, a legal family, and an Irish family. It meant a lot to him that he was Irish, didn't it?
It did. In fact, for him, his Irish Catholic heritage was all important. And there in Rockhampton, where he was the son of a judge, Frank Tennyson Brennan, but he was not just any judge, Frank Tennyson. He was one who was not liked by the establishment. He had been a Labor minister in the state Labor government up there. They'd even amended the legislation to allow someone who'd been a solicitor to be fairly promptly appointed to the Supreme Court. So he was always somewhat on the outer. So for Dad, his religious faith and his Irish heritage was something that sustained him, no matter what the establishment might hold against him and his father.
He was very conscious, was he not, of the interesting Irish legal history of this country, the role played from the earliest times in the colony by Irish-trained lawyers.
He was, and he gave some very significant speeches both here and in Ireland, where he drew on that heritage, and he saw it as a way by which to indicate that the Irish, in a sense, had pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. You've got to remember that there he was with the proud heritage that his great-grandmother, Annie Brennan, came as a widow to Maryborough in Queensland on the second only migrant ship to come into Maryborough. She came with five children, and she did the classic Irish thing, and she established with the Geraghty family the Brennan and Geraghty store, and they started to develop things and then insisted that their children have education, including the son Frank, who was my dad's father, who was one through education, was able to go into politics and then ultimately into the law.
He loved language, did he not?
He did, and he used to even read Jane Austen when he was on the High Court so as to be able to improve his literary style.
No.
He did.
That is splendid. Can you detect the cadences of Jane Austen in his in the CL Commonwealth Law Reports?
I can't pretend to do that. I'm not sufficiently literary, but I do know many lawyers who think that Brennan's writing is refreshing in that it avoids a lot of legalese.
But it reminds us that lawyers, and in particular judges, their business is words. Their business is persuasion and language.
Absolutely.
That they have to be good at it.
Yes. And the thing with my father is that he was, of course, an extraordinarily good advocate when at the bar. And I highlight in the book, for example, when he was involved with the Woodward Commission, some of the amazing advocacy before Sir Edward Woodward, where he put proposals to Woodward such as that Aboriginal people should have the right to own the minerals in their land. And he put to Woodward, this is the one big moral decision you have to make as a royal commissioner, because unless you do recommend this, they will never get it. What you recommend will be the high watermark of what is achievable by Aboriginal people. I remember he came home from the Northern Territory and he said to Mum and me, he said, well, I was in court up there in the Northern Territory today and they told me that the Irish had got away on me, and it took me years to find the transcript as to what he was referring to, and it was precisely this section.
Yes, yes. But he also talked about Irish inheritance, meaning independence and compassion in equal measure. And the point that makes so much difference in Australian history is that we keep having these Irish lawyers, as I say, going back to the earliest times in the colony, who had a shrewd understanding of the excesses of government and of authority. Did he have that?
Well, he had that because, David, he was brought up in Queensland. So he was not like a lot of the High Court who come from Melbourne or from Sydney. And he was brought up in Queensland at the bar during the very sensational times of Sir Joh Bjelke-Petersen, where the rule of law, it might be said, had a bad name, and he had to learn on the game as to how to advocate for what he saw as the rights and liberties of the individual over against the oppressive nature of the state.
In 1971, the Springbok Tour, the last sort of apartheid tour of football in Australia, and there were those who said that your father put on the line any chance of judicial preferment by,
yes,
as a barrister, writing in protest,
yes,
what Joh Bjelke-Petersen's,
yes,
police were doing to demonstrators against these white South African footballers in Brisbane.
Yes, and the background to it is interesting. It was August 1971. I was a first-year law student. Mum and Dad had gone south for the Australian Legal Convention, and Dad, as a young silk, a QC at the time, he was to be the first respondent to Sir John Bray from South Australia on a debate about law, liberty and morality, which was known as the Hart-Devlin debate, to English academics and lawyers who'd had debate about the place of law in shaping morality. Now, Dad, as a respondent, concluded his remarks at that conference in saying that he thought in future the issue issue wouldn't be so much to do with issues of sexuality, but rather issues to do with race and privilege and wealth. And so he also expressed the view that with the demonstrations going on in Queensland at the time, that this was an indictment of the legal profession, that the rule of law was falling short. So he came back to Queensland and he wrote a letter to the editor of the Australian newspaper, basically saying that everyone should examine their consciences. And he went to lunch in the Bar Common Room that day, and there was a fellow by the name of Peter Connolly who'd been a Liberal member of the state parliament. He was the doyen of the Queensland legal profession. And he said, "Well, Brennan, that's it. You'll never be a judge." And he came home that night and he said to Mum and me, he said, "Well, so be it." Well, 10 years later, David, he was a judge of the High Court of Australia.
I want to wind back a bit. There he is at the university in Brisbane. And clearly he did not see himself at that time, or indeed for the rest of his life, as an also-ran, because he became deeply involved in student politics.
Certainly did.
And what drove him to that? I mean, did he at some point actually have in mind a political career?
In those days, he thought some sort of political career might be possible, but he always dedicated himself to the law. I know he once said to me that after the Labor split, particularly in Queensland with Vince Gare, with the setting up of the Queensland Democratic Party and the whole Catholic secular debate, etc., I think at that stage he decided that definitely politics was not for him. But back in those days when he became the president of the NUAUS, I think he had an eye to
National Union of Australian University Students.
Yep. And he was there. He was on that committee with people like Peter Durack, people like John Stone. In fact, I remember an amusing story when Dad was on the High Court and he'd given some judgment on some social issue that John Stone took exception to, because John Stone, of course, had been head of Treasury, then became a National Party senator. And John Stone had written an article, I think, in the Finn Review, saying that, well, really, after all, Brennan was only an erstwhile student politician. And that night, Dad said to me, he said, "Well, I suppose that's true. I was the president and he was the treasurer of NUAUS at the time." They were both erstwhile politicians.
Indeed, they went on. They went on to, or particularly your father, went on to other things. Look, one more issue while I'm sort of clearing the ground a bit. Late in life, your father talked about the church into which he was born and talked of it as a ghetto church. What did he mean by that?
What he meant was that he had a strong conviction that one could hold religious beliefs, but one could hold one's head high in a pluralist democratic society such as Australia. And he was worried that the bishops were becoming increasingly focused on internal matters and trying to impose discipline, whereas for him it was that we have nothing to fear, we can profess our faith, and we can properly be out there in the public square engaging in what are our public duties. And I think he became very eloquent in being able to describe how someone with religious faith can still, for example, discharge the judicial office very faithfully in terms of interpreting the statutes, interpreting the constitution, developing the common law in accord with what he called the contemporary values of Australian society. And I think the constant battle for him in terms of the intellectual debate for himself was, what's the relationship between what we might call contemporary values of Australian society in a developing society which has become increasingly pluralistic and as one which is increasingly multi-faith and no faith at all? Because I think for him, his religious faith was a real impetus for providing what he regarded as fundamental, incontestable values about the human dignity of the person and the role of the state. And I think for him, the constant quandary was, how do we find those base values as society changes so rapidly?
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Frank Brennan about the two-volume collection that he has edited of his father, Sir Gerard Brennan's, writings and speeches. Frank, his first efforts in the courts were a complete catastrophe, but he was only about 13 years old, wasn't he?
He was. I mean, these were in the days, David, when Supreme Courts of States, particularly in remote areas like Rockhampton, where he was, they were run as a family show, if you like. So his father was the judge, so occasionally he and his sisters would be called in to perform the role of what's called associate, that is, the one who sits in front of the judge and would ensure that jurors were properly impaneled and the reading of the indictment and things of that sort. So I think it's probably to that to which you're referring.
There was something about, you know, reading out a charge or something that seemed to indicate that the counsel for the defence was a rapist.
Yes.
And went on from there.
He mistakenly identified the prosecutor as the accused in the proceedings.
Yeah.
So the defence counsel promptly got to his feet to indicate that he would be in a position to defend the prosecutor against such a charge.
But he was obviously a terrifically promising young man in the law.
Yes.
And he had some strokes of good fortune that took him a long way from the ordinary careers of young lawyers.
Absolutely.
He was the clerk to Justice Kenneth Townley, who was asked to preside over the War Crimes Tribunal on Manus Island. What did that mean to your father to be up on Manus Island trying Japanese prisoners of war in 1950?
So he was only 21 at the time. His father had died. The family needed to earn some income. So he took the job with Townley and he was there on Manus Island for many months. And a number of times he heard the death penalty imposed on Japanese prisoners of war. Suffice to say, thereafter, he was a passionate opponent of the death penalty, and he was then one who thought very acutely about what is the role, particularly in terms of criminal law processes.
Let's leap to the 1973. You have mentioned his role looking at Aboriginal land rights in the Northern Territory. Was this his first real experience of Aboriginal Australia, and what did it come to mean for him?
It was, but I think I have to preface it, David. One of the things about my father was that he was your classic barrister. He followed what they call the cab rank rule. Now,
take any job that comes along.
Anything that comes along, and it'll come as no surprise for you to know that in Queensland in those days, the most fashionable brief one could have would be to be involved in the annual arbitration to determine the price of sugar between the cane farmers and the Colonial Sugar Refinery Company. And so Dad was involved in those proceedings for many years. In Fiji, a man, Sir Ratu Kamisese Mara, who became a Prime Minister of Fiji, came to Australia looking for a barrister who might appear for the landowners against CSR, the Australian patronising company in Fiji, in an arbitration before Lord Denning. That was in 1969. That was Dad's first introduction to the idea of land rights, namely the indigenous rights of the Fijian people to maintain the title to their lands. He then came back to Australia because in his early years he'd been a very accomplished criminal advocate. There was then a very difficult case that confronted the Commonwealth of Australia in Papua New Guinea when a number of Tolai leaders in the Rabaul Peninsula had murdered the Commonwealth authorised district patrol officer. So it was a very politically charged case, and once again it was about land rights. And Dad was briefed by the Commonwealth to prosecute the case. And that's where he was consolidated once again in the sense about the entitlement of native peoples to their land rights. So then when he came back to Australia again, Woodward approached him and asked whether he would be the counsel for the Aboriginal people in the Woodward Royal Commission and whether he would appear for the Northern Land Council. So that was his first real exposure to Aboriginal people in remote communities. I should add that he had had experience, of course, with Aboriginal people in the courts in Queensland, particularly where there had been some police cases where the treatment of Aboriginal people was very adverse indeed. So he had the passion for the rights of these individuals, and then he'd increasingly developed a sense of what communal interests in land might be.
But he failed to persuade Woodward to the full extent that he wished, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And that was in relation to a couple of things, particularly in relation to mining rights. Dad was absolutely convinced that if you were to deny Aboriginal people ownership of the minerals in the land, that you would be denying them the reality of their land rights and the capacity for self-determination. And he knew that he was on a loser with that. Woodward said that he could not follow that recommendation. The second thing was in relation to the existence of Aboriginal rights continuing on pastoral leases. He fought very strenuously in the Woodward Commission to argue that it should be possible for Aboriginal people to maintain their connection with their land, even if it were subject to a pastoral lease.
So there was unfinished business there.
Oh, there was definitely unfinished business, and he always knew there was unfinished business. And I think what people haven't sufficiently appreciated is that Brennan was given the credit by Sir Edward Woodward and the chief anthropologist Nicholas Peterson that Dad was basically the chief architect of the key provisions of the Commonwealth Aboriginal Land Rights Act of the Northern Territory. Now, in hindsight, we had the good fortune that the Northern Territory government of the time was not very willing to accept the provisions of the Northern Territory legislation. So they appealed many, many cases to the High Court. So when Dad was on the High Court as a junior judge, having been a principal author of that legislation, the entire High Court was being educated into the reality of land rights. And that went on for a decade before the Mabo case came along. So it was in part thanks to the Northern Territory government that the High Court generally had been educated in what the reality of Aboriginal land rights was about.
On the way to the High Court, Gerard Brennan was a sort of a court builder, wasn't he? I mean, first on the Australian Law, he was on the Australian Law Reform Commission for a time, but then he was the first president of the new Commonwealth Administrative Appeals Tribunal. Then he was a foundation judge of the Federal Court.
Yeah.
Did he like the business of building institutions in that way?
He loved it, but he found it very demanding. And the thing was that he was, I mean, he'd been the president of NUAUS, as we've said. He then ultimately became the president of the Australian Bar Association. And then there were the years of the Whitlam government where there was a lot of reform that was going on. And the Whitlam government had briefed him on some very significant issues, including the extent to which corporations law could be amended and things of that sort. But then there was the change of government after November 1975, but the new Attorney General was Robert Ellicott, who really was a true legal reformer and a very fine legal mind, and who had a passionate commitment to reforming the system of what we call administrative law in Australia. That is the law which governs the relationship between the individual citizen and the state on all manner of things, social security or whatever. And so there was a move to set up this Administrative Appeals Tribunal and Administrative Review Council. And at the same time, as an initiative of the Whitlam government, there was the institution of the Australian Law Reform Commission with a very young, a very able, a very passionate Michael Kirby as its president. Well, lo and behold, Dad was asked to serve on the Australian Law Reform Commission and to be the founding president of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal and the Administrative Review Council. And then early in 1977, for the first time, the Commonwealth government set up the Federal Court of Australia, presided over by Nigel Bowen, who had been a leading politician and an outstanding member of the Sydney Bar. And Dad joined people like Bill Dean, John Toohey, as foundation members of that court.
Big names in the law, really.
Who ultimately all were headed for the High Court of Australia. So they were very reforming years, and they were great foundational years. And as Dad often said, he just happened to be there when the music stopped, and he was there on the chair.
I don't believe that kind of line for a moment, when the music stopped. I do love the fact that he was appointed to the High Court in February 1981 to take to fill the vacancy left by one Garfield Barwick.
Indeed, a judge about whom you know a great deal, David.
I've written a bit about Gar Barwick, but I can't imagine two High Court judges more dissimilar.
True, but it has to be said of Barwick, Barwick thought very highly of the old man, of Dad. He, a couple of things to say. In, I think it was 1973, Whitlam as Prime Minister asked Barwick for a list of names of people who might be possible High Court appointments. Now, Barwick gave Whitlam nine names, and Dad was second on the list. And only two of those nine names ultimately became High Court judges. They were Dad and Ronald Wilson. Then it was that same year there'd been a legal convention here in Perth, where I am at the moment, and the Robert Moore, you might remember from the ABC, used to run a program called Monday Conference. And
indeed,
Moore came to the Australian Legal Convention, had a panel discussion about the future of the legal profession and its social responsibility. Well, suffice to say, Dad wowed them, and Barwick, who'd been away at the time, came back from overseas and said to him, "Well, Brennan, I understand you saved the legal profession." So Barwick had a high opinion of him, and I remember in May each year, the High Court used to come to Brisbane when the weather was benign and the weather in the south was not so good, and there'd be a week or two of High Court sittings, and Dad, as a barrister, would be brief for quite a number of the cases. And I remember one occasion Barwick came across to the Bar Common Room and he hadn't seen Dad in court yet. And he said, "Well, Brennan, when are they bringing on the heavies?" And Dad said he'd be there tomorrow and he'd be there for the rest of the week. And he was.
A good business. A good business. Frank, when he became a judge of the High Court, he joined what he would often talk about as one of those people that nudges the law along. Mm. Tell us about this notion of nudging the law.
Yes. It goes back really to that 1971 legal convention I spoke about earlier. One of the people, in fact, the keynote speaker of that convention was Lord Diplock. This was in the days when we still had appeals to the Privy Council, so everyone tugged the forelock to the law lords who would come and visit Australia. And Diplock, at the opening of that legal convention in 1971, spoke about the development of the common law, and he said that basically most of us are just little nudges as we develop the common law gradually. But every now and again, as with Lord Mansfield, who made the famous decision about proclaiming that the slave should be let free, he said, every now and again there will be a Lord Mansfield, but most of us are little nudges. Well, guess what? There were two people in the audience that day. One was Dad, the other was Hal Wootton, who went on to become a very esteemed judge and Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody and Dean of the University of New South Wales Law School. Now, years later, when Dad was retiring, he gave the Wootton lecture, and at the introduction of that Wootton lecture, Wootton recalled what had been said by Lord Diplock back in 1971, and he said, in terms of the development of Aboriginal land rights, there are all the little nudges there have been, but Australia needed its Lord Mansfield, and that was Gerard Brennan. That is the one who was able to craft a judgment in Mabo which won community acceptance over time, and most importantly, won the acceptance of the judiciary generally, so that it could never be challenged in terms of its fundamental principles. And here we are over 30 years later, and that has proved to be the case.
The nudging required examining both the law and the conscience, didn't it, in your father's view?
Always.
And there was, in his writing, I see again and again and again, a confession of tension between those two, between what the law dictated and what conscience deemed to be just.
Yes.
And negotiating or dealing with that tension seems to have been a fundamental sort of theme of your father's life.
It has been, and as a judge, I think he always distinguished three key roles for a High Court judge, David. One was interpreting the Constitution, and that was that you have proper canons of construction and you're faithful to those. The second was statutory interpretation, and that interpreting a statute, if you could interpret the statute more consistently with human dignity and human freedom, then you did so. But then the third area of real possibility of development was what we call the development of the common law. That is the judge-made law where judges are asked to determine particular disputes. And that was the classic thing with Mabo. With Mabo, the High Court wasn't being asked to interpret the Constitution. They weren't there to interpret a statute. They were being asked what was the common law of the country in relation to the rights and liberties of the Indigenous people. And the key point in this, I think, is that in 1986, the Commonwealth Parliament passed the Australia Acts, which finally took away all links to the United Kingdom, all links to the Privy Council.
God, that must have been a relief.
Well, it was a complete relief. And in 1986, with a court which was led by Sir Anthony Mason and with minds on it like Dad and Bill Dean, what you had was a High Court of Australia that said, we are now the ultimate court of Australia and we are the ones who develop and proclaim the common law of Australia. And it was in that task that he always found the tension between conscience and what might be proper developments of the common law.
And argued that when the court was nudging things in a particular direction, that had to at least be respected by the community. And it had to not necessarily pander to community values, but it had to be respected, and that the law, that the development of the law required sort of the approval in some fundamental way of the community.
Yes.
He was also very clear that the community's values changed over time.
Yes. And I think that was always the most troubling quandary for him. It was really the question, are these values, are they simply transitional contemporary values, which are changing rapidly over time, or are they community values, which are, if you like, unalterable? Now, I think for most of his life, he basically was consoled by the thought that the Judeo-Christian ethic, particularly as informed by the best parts of what you might call Catholic social teaching, resonated with what he took to be those values of the Australian community. I think later in his life, he wondered whether in a society which was becoming increasingly pluralistic, increasingly multi-faith and none, where would you find the rock on which you would base this notion of values, from which you could then derive the principles from which you could then apply in order to develop the common law. And I think that remained a quandary for him forever. But if you go back and look at Mabo, yes, he was the one who went right back and quoted that wonderful judgment there in the International Court of Justice and finally said that we can't leave things frozen in an age of racial discrimination. And to see the quote that he put from that International Court of Justice was then actually placed in the Uluru Statement from the Heart, I think that sort of thing brought him great consolation. But he was still left wondering, what is the fundamental basis from which we can continue to derive principles for the development of the common law?
But if we go back to Green's case, here's a case which was of your father's, which has been much criticised in the years since. Green was a man accused of murdering another man who had made a homosexual advance on him.
Yes.
And out of the United States of America had come this argument that there should be a level of sort of tolerant understanding when following such an advance somebody is murdered. You could sort of understand the moral rage of the murderer, and rather than convicting them of murder, you should break the charge down to manslaughter. This case came before the court, and your father took the side of it being manslaughter, not murder. Why?
Yes, well, I'd correct your analysis of it slightly, David, and I'd say that Green's case, it was basically not about the common law. It was about interpreting a particular statutory provision, which was Section 23 of the New South Wales Crimes Act. And basically that statutory provision passed by Parliament said, all right, you've got someone who's committed a murder, but they would not be guilty of murder if they were provoked in the following way. And it spoke of an act or an omission which results in the loss of self-control on the part of the accused that was induced by any conduct of the deceased, including grossly insulting words or gestures. So basically, as I read it, the approach of the majority in that case, which was Brennan, Toohey and McHugh, was to say, well, it's a matter for the jury to determine first whether this person was provoked, and second, whether or not that provocation was such as would have induced an ordinary person to do what he did. And so, in the end, the real division in Green's case, in terms of the interpretation of the statute, as I read it, was, is it simply for a matter for the jury to determine those things? Or, as Justices Kirby and Gummo said, well, look, we don't think it's imaginable in any circumstances that an ordinary person could react in this way. So it was, in the end, I think, a case of statutory interpretation.
But your father's decision was deeply led by his faith, was it not? And his belief in the profound sin of homosexuality.
Well, I know you've always held that view, but I'm not so convinced of that. I mean, as I understand it, the key issue that came to the High Court was here you had a 22-year-old man who'd been in a situation with a 36-year-old man in his residence, and there'd been an exchange between them. The argument of the 22-year-old man was that he wanted to put before the jury the fact that his own father had sexually abused his sisters and that that was a trigger for something. Now, was that a matter for the jury or not? I don't think that part of it, David, was any way related to homophobia, but I may be wrong.
This is Radio National, and I'm David Marr on Late Night Live talking to Frank Brennan about his father, the former Chief Justice of the country, the author of The Mabo Judgment, Sir Gerard Brennan. Frank, he retired too soon. I mean,
he did. That's because we amended the Constitution to say you have to go at 70.
And that's because High Court judges were hanging around into their 90s.
It is, but as Murray Gleeson, who later became Chief Justice, said, I remember on one occasion, would have been far better if we amended the Constitution to say that federal judges will retire at an age set by the Parliament. So we could have set it at 70 back then, but nowadays you'd do it at 75 or 80. But Bob Ellicott, who was a wizard at constitutional change, God help us, he got 3 of the 8 successful referendums in Australian history through, and one of them was retirement ages of the judges. Now, you'd appreciate this with your scholarship on Barwick, that one of the real reactions was to the legendary Sir Edward McTiernan.
Yes.
Now, Eddie was on the High Court for 46 years.
Appointed in the 1930s.
Indeed. And I remember when Barwick was Chief Justice, he once came along and said to the barristers, God help us, Eddie's just bought a new set of robes. And I remember at one stage, I had the good fortune to be working for Sir William Dean, and there was a view that I might write a biography of Eddie McTiernan.
Oh, no.
But Don't worry, it didn't come to be, because in the end, Eddie wanted it to be a ghost-written autobiography, which would have been a very boring tome indeed. But anyway, Eddie pointed out to me one day that it was not customary for the High Court to have a formal farewell for the puny judges, but only for the Chief Justice. And so Barwick made an exception, I think very happy to get Eddie off the court, and gave a formal speech about Sir Edward being on the court for 46 years. And so I was commissioned by Eddie to approach Jim Merrills, QC at the Melbourne Bar, who was a very proper chap, who was the editor of the Commonwealth Law Reports, to see whether or not he would reprint in the Commonwealth Law Reports the speech that Barwick gave. Merrill sat at his desk with his pen in hand and looked up at me and said, "I regret to inform Sir Edward that the next time we'll read of him in the Commonwealth Law Reports will be upon the occasion of his death."
Do you know the story that is said of how Barwick finally got rid of Eddie McTiernan at the age of 90-whatever?
No.
Well, by this time, Eddie was in a wheelchair, and apparently Barwick refused to... authorise the construction of a ramp to get the wheelchair up onto the judicial dais in the High Court's room in Sydney.
Yep. Well, thankfully, we have now got a change in community values and in legislation, David, and it would be necessary to provide for the person with disability in the workplace.
Indeed, no such cruelty would ever be contemplated today. But Frank, retirement, early as it was, did kind of free your father when a number of big issues faced Australia, freed him to speak in a way that he really hadn't been able to speak for,
absolutely,
20 or so years.
Yes.
There was the unfortunate fate of the 1999 referendum on the Republic.
Yes.
And he was a Republican through and through, was he not?
Republican through and through, but could see the perils of having a directly elected president. And I dare say in the Trump era, a lot more Australians will come to see the perils of a directly elected president. In fact, if I may say, I remember after the whole native title debate when Paul Keating was Prime Minister, I went to see Keating one day in his office in Parliament House in Canberra, and the Republic was being debated at the time. And Keating said to me, he said, "Look, if you had direct election of a president," he said, "there'd be no point in hanging around here. There'd be nothing to do, namely that the power would rest with the fully elected president."
We'll have a full-scale debate sometime, Frank, about elected versus non-elected.
Indeed.
But remind me, why did Keating call you the meddling priest?
Oh, well, that was at the time of the so-called Wick debate. So after the Wick decision, when
Which we've glossed over.
Yes.
We have glossed over.
Before I come to Keating's treatment of me, what should be pointed out is, as I indicated before, Dad, as barrister, was a passionate advocate for the rights of the Aboriginal people to maintain their native title rights on a pastoral lease. When it came to the actual Wick decision, he dissented. He wrote the key dissent where he said that in terms of judicial functions, we cannot develop the common law so that there would be a conflict of rights between two groups on the one area of land. He said that would be an unwarranted extension of the common law, that here is a moral wrong in need of correction, but it could only be done by the Parliament. So I think it's a wonderful instance that people who wonder, well, how could your father write the majority judgment in Mabo but dissent in Wick? Very clearly, very easily, namely applying the same judicial method. But did he think there was a moral shortcoming in the law on pastoral leases? He sure did, and he put it very eloquently back in 1973. Well, post-Wick, Howard, of course, was wanting to wind back provisions of the Native Title Act, and the question was how a compromise could be struck. Well, lo and behold, we had the perfect, dreadful cocktail where Brian Harradine, the Catholic senator from Tasmania, had the balance of power in the Senate, and you had a situation where Howard was trying to negotiate a deal with Harradine. And so when I ultimately endorsed what Harradine had done, because I thought it was an improvement on what was on offer, then at that stage Keating came out and said that I was a meddling priest, namely that it was no part of my role to be giving an endorsement to what Harradine had done, when in fact I think what Harradine did, he was given under cover of night a compromise proposal in relation to mining by the National Indigenous Working Group, and he went in hard with Howard in order to get it. In fact, I remember, David, it was just after there'd been a Queensland election where Borbidge, the National Party Premier, had lost office, and more importantly, Pauline Hanson had won 11 seats in the Queensland Parliament. Now, I knew there was no way that Howard would risk a double dissolution election where Pauline Hanson would then get the balance of power. So I said to Harradine, now is the time to strike, because Borbidge is out of the equation, Howard won't risk a double dissolution election, and you'll be able to bring home the bacon. So that's what I did, and Paul was very upset and called me a meddling priest.
Do you know what he called me?
No.
Gore Vidal without the talent. It's good, isn't it?
It's very good.
I wear that as a badge of honour.
Yeah.
But I've written a celebratory essay on Harradine's role in that confrontation. But what it also allowed your father to do was to publicly back things like the Biluila family.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, tell us the story of that, because I love the modesty of his approach.
He, by that stage, was in a nursing home. Mum had died. He knew that he didn't have long to live, but he was very troubled. He'd been very troubled for many years about Australian refugee policy, way back with Tampa and all of the rest of it. You might remember he was involved in the key judgment called Chu King Lim, which set out the limits of Commonwealth power. But then he, like many of us, was troubled at the increasing incursions that were being made by Commonwealth governments of all sorts. But in relation to the Biluila family, he said, well, look, here is a child born in Australia, so here is an Australian child who is being punished for the behaviour of her parents. And he was absolutely adamant that this was an absolute betrayal of Australian values, that we in Australia would never punish an Australian child because of the wanton actions of the parents. And so he wrote the last letter to the editor that he ever wrote from his nursing home. And what's more, David, when he died, he died a day after, I think, the word came through that the Biluila family were to be given their visas, and he smiled so benignly and so delightedly.
He signed his letter?
Gerard Brennan Bronte.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Did he ever doubt his faith?
I don't think he did. He definitely had lots of reservations about some of the bishops. Even in the books you see, I have reproduced some correspondence between himself and Cardinal George Pell.
Yes, that's where I was nudging you, Frank.
But the thing about Dad was he always had a high regard for the popes of his time. He regarded the intellectual rigour of John Paul II as second to none. He thought that Benedict was a truly educated European with great nuance. And he was over the moon about Pope Francis, who basically said, look, I'm going to leave all that theology alone. We've just got to become a church which is more open, which is more merciful, and preaches the joy of the gospel. So that was important to him. In terms of the conflict with someone like Pell, what Dad was absolutely passionate about was the conscience of the individual, that I may have religious faith, I may be part of a church which has a hierarchy, but basically I need to form my conscience, I need to inform that conscience, and to that conscience be true. And when he gave utterance to something like that in a public lecture, Pell wrote to him joining issue, and even saying he couldn't understand how a judge could say the things that Dad was saying. And Dad wrote back and I think had the argument, namely that it was absolutely essential to respect the conscience of the individual.
But Pell's letter is so fabulously hard line. It's just...
Oh, yes.
It's just magnificently so himself.
But I think the wonderful thing is the robustness of Dad's reply and at the same time the respect which is shown to a religious authority. And I think that's very admirable.
Respect without mercy? Can that be a special kind of category? But, you know, Pell had declared that the notion of the primacy of conscience was a virus that has severely weakened our resistance to the hostile currents in Western life. And reading
Pope Francis had put that well to rest, and that caused Dad and me great delight, I have to say.
Yes, I got the feeling also in your father's reply to Pell, a sort of sense that, look, George, I'll obey the Pope, not you.
Yes.
You're a bit down the line, really, George.
Dad was never one who consorted much with bishops. He always had a great regard for his parish priests, whoever they might be. Particularly Stephen Sinn, a Jesuit there at King's Cross. They had a wonderful relationship over the years. But I remember, for example, and I have the photo there in the books, when Pope John Paul II was coming to Australia in 1986, Dad was invited to greet him at Fairbairn Air Base, not at the request of any bishop, but at the request of Gibbs as Chief Justice of the High Court to represent him there at those proceedings. And Dad was very chuffed that he got to meet the Pope, but not at the institution of any bishop.
What's the religious composition of the High Court today?
Oh, I'm not sure what it is at the moment, but I do remember a funny story, David, about the time of the Dogs case. And shortly
explain the Dogs case.
The Dogs case was a case about the constitutional validity of the payment of state aid. And after that case, there'd been a vacancy on the court and Michael McHugh was appointed to the court. And Dogs campaigners expressed outrage that now five of the six High Court judges had been to Catholic schools. And I probably shouldn't say this, but I will. That morning, Sir Anthony Mason knocked on the door of Sir Gerard, and Sir Anthony, of course, went to Sydney Grammar. But he just said to Dad, they obviously don't realise that my first 2 years at school were with the Loreto sisters, so it should have been 6 out of 7, not 5.
And the Dogs were knocked back.
They were.
Yes. So we have one of the strangest education systems in the world.
Well, it's a very different education system, but it's one at the moment which is proving very popular with parents, even though they have to pay for it.
And well, they have to pay a bit, Frank, but the nation pays stupendous sums to give parents a chance to send kids to schools like the ones you and I went to. It's amazing,
indeed,
isn't it?
It is.
It only costs tens of billions a year.
We'll talk about that another time, David.
We've got so much left to talk about. There are some profound disagreements here, but the clock is at the hour and we must stop.
Oh, alas. But it's been wonderful.
Alas.
Glad to catch up again. Yeah.
I have been talking to Frank Brennan, Jesuit priest, lawyer, educated.
Oh, thank you.
No, there's no higher praise, Frank. Educated. And the editor of these two splendid volumes of his father's writings and speeches. So these aren't the judgments. These are the writings, the speeches, the letters, the occasional addresses, edited by Frank, available from Connor Court in, I presume, all right-thinking bookshops, Frank.
One would hope so,
yes. One would hope so. Thanks very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you. Wonderful to be with you, David. Thank you.
And that's the show. On our next, we're talking design and how it shapes society. The design of prisons, the design of streets that led to the criminalization of pedestrians about a century ago, and the infuriating, unalterable QWERTY keyboard, a clunky old design that will surely never die. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.